for Ali. They said, no, this is not for only Ali, for everyone. Better not use it. Just use radiallahu anhu. Unfortunately, this bid'ah is spreading among the Sunnis now. Unlike the past where whenever they would say Ali, they would say karramallahu wajhu. Now they are starting to say Ali radiallahu anhu. Why? Because these websites say that you have to treat the Sahaba equally. They even have problem with the Shias using the term alayhi salam for Ali. They bring this whole issue, well, alayhi salam is only used for Anbiya and Mursaleen and not for others. And this is where I would like to say that, you know, the Wahhabis call themselves Salafis. Salafis means those who follow the early generations of Islam. Wahhabis are not really Salafis.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Black and white.
La degradación del medio ambiente.
In general, environmental degradation is a phenomenon of our times. The types of economy and production cause these catastrophic events. There is also one more reason: how humans have interacted with natural resources. Undoubtedly, humans are an integral part of the environment. Humans impact the environment. The environment is meaningless without the human being who values it, takes care of its quality, and ensures its existence. But in the case of humans, we don't talk about them in abstract terms. We're talking about humans who form societies with certain characteristics, with forms of production, with social, economic, and cultural aspects. They harm a number of humans in some cases and benefit a minority. According to data from the United Nations, in 2016, 90% of the wastewater in developing countries, without being processed, flows into rivers and lakes. This same United Nations report also states that in that same year of environmental crisis, 2016, approximately 7 million people died worldwide due to climate issues. The World Health Organization, WHO, states that in the last decade, 95% of natural catastrophes have caused a total of 600,000 deaths, of which 95% belong to poor countries. The issue is how we can achieve environmental justice that is closely related to social justice with a paradigm shift, with a change in society, a change in the relationship between the production, distribution, and uses of natural resources. How are science and technology used at the service of environmental quality? Because our treatment of the environment has impacts on us as well. Humans are a part of environment. For the same reason, there aren't any contradictions nor struggles between humans and the environment. Such an opinion is absurd and absolutely false. We shall consider it as a whole. We can only speak of an environmental change to the extent that there is a social change and a change in the relations of production and profit. We should realize how development is closely related to the sustainable nature of the environment. According to science and technology, we need a sustainable and transformable environment for development and for the benefit of quality of life. Ultimately, we are aware, at least on our part, that the environment is the common home of humans and all the species that live in it. But indisputably, humans are the ones who value it the most. We are humans, and it is our responsibility to take care of environmental quality. Today, profound transformations of a social nature are being proposed, without which there is no environmental change, without which there cannot be a favorable environment for the majority or for humanity as a whole. The liberation of humanity as a whole depends on environmental change. I'm Eduardo Artes. This is Black and White. Today in our program, I talk to Cristobal Rodriguez. He's an environmental activist and advocate. He's also a member of an organization which has a very long name. Please introduce yourself and the organization.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Eduardo. I'm a member of Movement for the Defense of Access to Water, Land and Environmental Protection.
Bienvenido, Cristobal.
You are very welcome to our program. What is the role of environmental movement on the international, national, and Latin American levels? What is the relationship between this movement and the proposals for social transformation, together with the trade union movements, social movements, villagers, indigenous people, etc.?
Your first question is very interesting because we're currently experiencing an unprecedented climate crisis. These organized movements can come up with suggestions in face of socio-environmental conflicts. The whole world is affected by this crisis. We cannot allow life on Earth to be at these critical levels. We have observed different international reports that tell us about the increase in temperatures throughout the world. This undoubtedly has repercussions. For example, regarding trade unions, it affects all productive activities that are based on some natural resources. Talking about fishing, when the temperature rises in the ocean, there's less diversity in the sea. In agricultural terms, there's a shortage of rainfall. Global warming and climate change also affect the mining. That is why it is a global movement.
Perfecto, pero...
Well, is there any conflict of interest between environmental and trade union movements? Imagine that one of these causes environmental contamination. I know that there are many reasons. For instance, the companies don't spend the amount of money needed or many other ones. But sometimes there is an inconsistency between environmental and trade union movements. I think that this problem is related to everyone.
Of course, we also have to understand that we, as humans, workers of labor unions and companies, are parts of an ecosystem. We shall have a permanent and careful dialogue. In the environmental movement in Chile, we have realized that if we are not capable of taking care of our natural resources, we cannot have a job. Cities are becoming unsustainable over time. So I think that before addressing the extent of work, we must face the dimension of sustainable living. There are going to be waves of migrations due to climate change. We witnessed that phenomena in Central America. Climate change decreases the amount of cultivation, and that is why this amount of population has to immigrate to find sources of work. We should not exclusively look at it just as a contrast between things, but it is a more complementary phenomenon.
We shall consider it as a model of a different society. When the Industrial Revolution develops, it obviously creates a type of relationship formed from environmental defects that include well-being of the workers, young people, children, etc. Who suffers? A large number of people, while others aren't harmed.
That's right. We know that the climate crisis is going to affect the poorest populations in the world. But we also have to highlight the responsibility of great producing powers in this same crisis. So there's an expansion of certain economies during the Industrial Revolution, which affects countries like Chile. The climate crisis impacts third world countries and countries in the global south as well. If we consider the world or the planet Earth as a system, we cannot allow it to continue happening. Any transformation or change within an ecosystem has repercussions in all parts. We're not the only ones who face water crisis. Water crisis has repercussions in local, regional, national, subcontinental, and continental development, and ultimately the entire world. This development model has caused a very serious problem.
This development model causes a serious problem. There are some cases at the international level that different sectors of society, along with workers who were interested in the environmental issue, could come together and raise their voices. It happened in Argentina and Europe. We are in Chile right now. Did we have such an experience? Was there any unanimous voice in defense of the environment that considered the quality of life of all the people?
This point is very important. Most of the time, our general conception is that the environmental issue doesn't have political, economic, and social aspects. When we talk about the environmental issue, all these variables are included. For instance, in case of Chile, the largest holders of capital, like Luxic Group and Angelini Group, generate their wealth from the possession of natural resources. In this scenario, we face an economic problem. Recently, we witnessed the Corpesca case. Jaime Orpiz is released from his pretrial detention due to the fishing law. That is why natural resources have a political component. We highlight these social problems when we talk about the poorest population in Chile that has a productive field essentially based on monoculture. So the first thing we have to do is generate those visions and stop thinking that the environmental issue isn't related to the political, social, and cultural aspects. What kind of experience do we have in Chile? I think that we live in a country where neoliberalism emerged in the most radical way. For example, as a movement, we have the governance of Valparaíso, that is the second largest region in Chile. So we question this centralism by occupying the institutions for the decentralization of the country. This is a vivid example to reverse these failed development model policies.
It is a development model proven to be unsuccessful. This model actually doesn't benefit the people. Let's have a break, and then we continue our program immediately. We continue our talk in black and white with Cristobal Rodriguez, who is an environmental defender. As a member of this environmental movement, what do you think about this discrepancy between development and developmental sustainability according to social conceptions? I believe that humans are the ones that determine everything in the end. I mean that everything is related to them, who are in the center of everything.
Your
question is very interesting because it represents a paradigm shift. It also helps us to stop thinking that growth and development are unlimited. We must put the limit to growth. We've been in the ecological overshoot of planet Earth for a couple of weeks. This means that we are almost following the neoliberal principles of living in debt. As a movement, we believe that we have to start talking about a new economic model to replace the current one. This new economic model should not question sustainability of life on Earth, the respect of human rights, and the conservations not only of the species, but also of our indigenous people. So we come to realize that humans are a part of the whole, and we're not necessarily the most important component of this system.
We're not the most important ones?
Not necessarily. We shall consider ourselves as complementary entities within this system. It's not the theory of the system. The span of species are not important in this system. We are equally important in this system. I insist on the word system because we cannot consider things in an individualistic way, but rather a part of the whole.
De acuerdo.
Perfect. The point is about the development of existence of rational and conscious humans who value the environment. The environment exists because humans value, recognize, and feel it. Humans are a part of the environment. Whatever happens to the environment has impacts on humans as well, and vice versa. However, humans have the ability to transform the environment. They started this transformation from early times to today. We should not only consider the recent years in this case, but it is not possible for humans to transform and recreate the environment according to their needs. It actually does not mean going backwards, but rather a leap forward in an evolutionary chain.
Yes, it could have happened during the 20th century. Regarding the 21st century, we can mention a chapter of our 2022 constitution that was rejected. This chapter spoke of the rights of nature. So we must have an equal understanding before the law. Without people, the nature has to be defended or have access to equal judgment. There's a period in which people stop having an anthropocentric vision in the 20th century, and then they believe that humans are a fundamental part of this transformation, but not the only part. I need to emphasize that humans are not the most important ones. If we extrapolate to other values, for example, democratic ones, we understand that in nature, these new democratic forms that we need are replicated in the most precise and perfect way. Therefore, we do not necessarily need to be the greatest force, but rather we have to learn to dialogue, share, learn and question what is provided for us by others. All of these points ultimately make up this new paradigm. We believe in it and work for it.
Yes, of course, but finally humans are the ones that will represent non-human interests within nature. And these are the same humans that make legislations for such interests. Humans will provide opportunities for other humans. In short, I believe that it is the human being, the subject and owner of everything. Humans are an indisputable part of the environment. We actually don't destroy the environment, but we damage our own lives. Undoubtedly, human being needs the environment, so he needs a society that generates a certain type of quality and dignity of life. But the human being is the one who decides and determines the transformation. He can even determine the creation of artificial lakes and mountains. He can determine everything. But it does not mean that he is destroying nature, because nature itself is something that is constantly changing, even without the presence of human being.
Eduardo, under this vision, how does a river return to its source? Here, the role of water is very important. It is no human intervention for a river to flow again where it has flowed for thousands of years.
There are physical and material conditions that determine water under a certain type of amount of accumulation, rain or snow, to have a certain path. Humans have to study this process scientifically.
respected, taken into account, and not build in surrounding areas to prevent catastrophes. Humans should not create an unsuitable environmental situation, because at the end of the day, it impacts all aspects of our life. We have to bear in mind that it profoundly affects the poorest and vulnerable people, because they're the ones who build their houses along the riverbanks. In short, nature has its course, and humans have to learn from it by achieving necessary science and technology. Human beings must use nature in terms of respect, not the way people are using it right now, which is so bad, because otherwise we destroy our quality of life. This is the relation that exists between human beings and nature.
It could be considered a fallacious premise that the technology has no limits in its development. This has been proved wrong. We still haven't been able to reach full technological potential in a lot of things.
But technological and scientific capabilities are everlasting and will continue until the last day.
Not necessarily. There are certain natural resources that cannot be recovered.
This is a different issue.
For us, it is part of the same thing, because we understand this as a systemic thought. For instance, we implement extractive projects and deplete natural resources like copper, molybdenum, gold, and lithium. This technical and technological development will end someday. We must pay attention to the fact that close to 70% of the water used at the mine's sites cannot be recovered, not even for human consumption. We're setting scientific limits on these technical, economic, and social developments.
In these few minutes that are left for us, please explain to us the major challenges that you see in the environmental movement in view of this great social upheaval, exclusively with the danger of a world war.
Probably the majority of your audience is in Chile, so the first change we face in Chile today is related to the access to water. In our country, there are 300,000 people who do not have access to water. It's a challenge that bears relations to human rights and quality of life. If we extrapolate this issue to a global context, we're seeing that the current climate crisis is going to cause a number of changes in ways of life that are inevitably going to lead to higher levels of conflict. We shall be capable of observing such dangerous signs. We don't need to foresee, because the disaster is in front of our eyes. The problem is that we don't see it every day. For instance, the temperature rises to a certain degree that the body of the human being can't tolerate anymore, but the planet as a whole can put up with that. We have to be aware of the disasters. I think that it is the second challenge that we face nowadays. As I mentioned in the beginning of our conversation, we have to be able to understand the system as a whole. We should understand the socio-environmental conflicts beyond environmental activism, union policies, and the current system. This is the most major challenge in our times, where certain identity politics is imposed. We have to look at this again in a systemic and complementary way in which each part functions as a micro-universe, but at the same time influences what happens around it.
Is it possible to improve the quality of the environment by continuing with the current social, economic, and political systems that exist in most countries?
It's absolutely impossible, because these systems caused this crisis.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Cristobal. I hope you continue your work in the environmental movement. Until next time on Black and White.
Thank you, Eduardo. I wish you the best.
Thank you.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell."
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime has normalized the killing of Palestinian children, and that is because the UN and the Western regime's inaction towards the heinous crimes committed by the Israeli regime. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International noted two Palestinian children, both 14 years old, shot by Israeli regime forces during their military invasion of Jenin refugee camp on June 19th, died of their wounds. Ahmad Sagher died the same day after an Israeli regime troop shot him in the abdomen. Sadil, the other victim, died in Jenin government hospital on June 21st. An Israeli regime troop shot her in the head as she filmed the military assault on her phone standing in front of her home. Jenin refugee camp is home to 22,000 Palestinians. They were forcibly displaced from their homes in the regions of Haifa and Carmel Mountains in 1948 and have been denied since then the right of return in violation of Article 13 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Jenin is cramped. It is tightly packed where Palestinians have to negotiate narrow alleys and warrens to reach their houses. Most other Palestinian towns and villages are no different as their living space shrinks under the ever-expanding illegal Zionist settlement. Defense for Children International Palestine said in a statement on June 21st, "Both of these children, Ahmad Sagher and Sadil, were shot and killed by Israeli regime forces in broad daylight, demonstrating that Israeli forces enjoy complete impunity and have no fear of repercussions. Killing Palestinian children has become so routine that Western rulers treat such murders with a hardly repressed yawn. If an Israeli regime soldier is killed or harmed, Western rulers go berserk. They demand that the culprits be apprehended and punished. When the Zionist regime perpetrates crimes against the Palestinians, Western rulers in unison parrot the line, 'Israel has the right to defend itself.' No such right is afforded to the Palestinians who are under occupation. International law is clear. People under occupation have the right to resist their occupiers by any means necessary. Western regimes conveniently ignored this rule when it comes to the rights of the Palestinians. In their formulation, Palestinian lives do not matter. Only Israelis' lives do. According to a June 12th report in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, Israeli forces and settlers killed 28 Palestinian children this year. Add to that the killing of two Palestinian children in Jenin, and the number surpasses 30 children this year killed already. Following the Zionist regime's now routine bombing of Gaza Strip on April 7th, in which a number of children were killed. The heartbreaking story of two-year-old Mohammad al-Tamimi stands out as a shocking example of the Zionist regime's brutality. Shot in the head by an Israeli regime force on June 1st, the infant died 4 days later of his injuries. Killing Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip has now become routine. Last year was the deadliest since 2005. When the largest number of Palestinians were killed. This year has already surpassed last year's gory record of killings. The Middle East Eye reported, since the start of the year, Israeli regime forces and settlers have killed at least 170 Palestinians, including 25 children. Providing a breakdown of fatalities, the Middle East Eye's report said that 134 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank and East Al-Quds, and another 36 in the Gaza Strip. The West Bank killings included 3 Palestinians killed in a drone strike on June 21st. The Zionists have targeted Jenin and Nablus in the West Bank as well as East Al-Quds. The tiny Gaza Strip, besieged from all sides, is subjected to regular Israeli regime bombings from the air as well as missiles and artillery strikes. Jenin and Nablus are targeted because they have emerged as centers of resistance. Palestinian youth residing in these two locales are absolutely fed up of Zionist crimes. They feel that if they have to be killed or maimed, they might as well go down fighting. The Zionist regime's army's June 19 attack on Jenin was typical. It resulted in the killing of 6 people, which 91 were wounded. At least 31 of them are in critical condition. 2 children were also shot and killed. One the same day and the other 2 days later. True to their dishonest nature, Western media outlets refer to the Zionist regime's murder of Palestinians as clashes. In an analytical piece, Al Jazeera columnist Belen Fernandez exposed the Western media fraud when she wrote that calling Israeli killings of Palestinians as clashes is to equate the neck and the guillotine. Meanwhile, the website of the New Arab wrote the UN repeatedly excluding Israel from the list of regimes that commit violations against children is deeply hypocritical, given the Secretary General himself has described the hellish lives of Palestinian children in Gaza. If there is a hell on earth, it is the lives of children in Gaza. These were the words of Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, during the May 2021 Israeli regime bombardment of the Gaza Strip. It is a stark statement, leaving no question as to the brutality and violence experienced by Gaza's residents, about half of whom are children. The United Nations General Assembly created the Special Representative of the Secretary General for Children and Armed Conflict following a 1996 report that comprehensively documented how children are disproportionately affected by armed conflict. Since 2001, the mandate of this office includes what has colloquially been called a list of shame, naming perpetrators that kill, harass, and otherwise threaten the lives and well-being of children. However, what was both surprising and yet utterly predictable was exclusion of the fabricated regime of Israel from the list, a list compiled by Guterres, considering the same report outlined the multiple attacks on children committed by both the Israeli regime military and by Zionist settlers. In fact, even with decades of documentation of the Zionist regime's violations of Palestinian children's rights, including countless reports issued by the United Nations itself, the fabricated regime of Israel has never been included on the list, despite the inclusion of other parties whose violations do not reach the scope of the Zionist regimes.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. And we would like to actually express our condolences and sorrow and sadness for the martyrdom of, the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, peace be upon him. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic laws regarding the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein, or in commemoration of his martyrdom, and also Arba'in. Well, before that, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Khamenei, and we'll be back. Don't go away. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, They said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws about mourning and azadari with relation to the month of Muharram and Safar, commemorating the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and his holy companions. With Sheikh Javid, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible to form a rally marching to and fro or to and from the shrines of the infallibles on the day of their demise?
Well, this is symbolic in its sense. There is, of course, no problem in marching or forming a rally going back and forth between from the shrines and to the shrines, of course. And this has recently Shia Muslims do this, and even in Shia Muslims in other countries where there is no shrine do this as in a symbolic act, as an act to commemorate the event of the martyrdom of a given imam, let's say. There is no objection in it.
Mm-hmm. Sheikh Javid, I've seen people, of course, very few people who are not very much sensitive to the health issues and hygiene when it comes to the rallies and the events where these rituals commemorating the mourning ceremonies is concerned, you know. Is it permissible for such individuals to take part in such rallies while ignoring and violating hygienic rules?
Well, unfortunately, this is one of the issues, one of the problems pilgrims face in Iraq or in some during the occasion, especially occasion of Arba'in, you know, when they take part in these rallies. There is no proper arrangement for the plastic bags to be disposed of.
Yes.
And therefore, pilgrims end up throwing their
disposable
plastic cups.
Disposable cups.
At the side of the road.
Or litter away.
Yeah, they're just litter, of course. And this is a very not a beautiful scene that we see in especially during the season of Arba'in.
It's very harmful to the environment.
Yeah, it is definitely harmful to the environment, and it creates pollution.
Mm-hmm.
It creates risk for the pilgrims, and it can cause a lot of problems for the pilgrims. So it's always necessary and to take every measure to observe hygienic rules when as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. What's the Islamic law about women taking part in such rallies?
Well, we do see that Shia women take part in these rallies. They attend and they participate in the processions, in the majalis, just as men do. There's no problem in doing so. It is, of course, they will earn the reward for doing azadari during this during the season of azadari. Of course, they are allowed to do this, but of course, they should also keep in mind that they should observe hijab, they should take care of their modest clothing, and they should not mix with men as far as it is possible for them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. With me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program, and Shah Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws about mourning ceremonies of the master of the martyrs, almost saying peace be upon him. Well, Shah Javid, what's the significance of Arba'een in the eyes of, or in the opinion of, His Eminence Ayatollah Khomeini?
Well, Arba'een is indeed an excellent occasion to think over the meaning of the uprising of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, as we see millions of people gather for Arba'een, Arba'een rally or Arba'een procession on the way to Karbala, carrying colorful blacks, flags, and, you know, some wearing black, and some chanting slogans, expressing their emotion and sentiments. So there's no doubt that speaking from a Sharia perspective, it is recommended to visit the shrine of the Imam, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, and other Imams, especially during Arba'een, while doing ziyarah and participating in azadari and commemorating the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the 40th day of Imam Hussein. There are narrations which suggest that, okay, prominent companions of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, like Jabir bin Abdullah al-Ansari, actually visited the grave of Imam Hussein on the 40th day of his martyrdom in Karbala. So when it comes to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khomeini's perspective, the Supreme Leader of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, he has on different occasions pointed out the need and the necessity of taking part in this procession. And see, he has even said, and I just want to quote him. He said that, have you seen that gathering? Have you seen that great movement comprised of millions of people between Najaf and Karbala? Have you seen the movement between Najaf and Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam? Have you seen that excitement and enthusiasm? Have you seen that movement? When such movements are necessary to be launched, even if some danger is involved, the same excitement and enthusiasm exists in our nation, in our people, and in our youth. This should be preserved. And this is what guarantees the survival of this country. This is unquote, and this is the end of his saying regarding Arbaeen. So, and surely, of course, it also guarantees the survival and self reproduction of the global Shia community. So it is highly important and very much essential to hold the Arbaeen, to take part in the Arbaeen rally and to commemorate this important event, which has become very much, critical and very much vital for the Shia. To show themselves, to show its strength and power and cohesion and unity across the globe.
Mm-hmm. Shamsovit, considering the current geopolitical circumstances, can it be said that the Arbaeen pilgrimage is an obligatory duty in this day and age?
Well, the Arbaeen pilgrimage is a highly commendable and recommended act of devotion. Now, Arbaeen rally is truly an unprecedented event, not only in our own times, but also in history. We do not know of any similar gathering in history which is organized more warmly every year. It is unprecedented. You know, the logic of Imam Hussein bin Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam is the logic of defending the truth and resistance against oppression, transgression, deviation, arrogance. This is the logic of Imam Hussein. Today the world needs this logic. Today the world is witness to the rule of kufr, arrogance and corruption. The world is witness to the rule of oppression. The message of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam is the salvation of the world. The great movement of Arbaeen conveys this message to the whole world. And by Allah's favor and grace, this movement should be strengthened on a daily basis.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein plan to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new lands.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.